Welcome to Crawl Space. I'm Tim, here today with Lance. Lance, how's it going today?
Tim, I couldn't be better. How are you today?
I am doing great. We had a wild and wonderful weekend in Boston with the podcast True Crime Obsessed and our guest on this episode, Maggie Freeling, because we did a show at the Wilbur Theater talking about the disappearance of Maura Murray documentary from Oxygen that we were a part of back in 2017. And Lance, we're doing the show again in Philadelphia on October 1st. You gotta be there. October 1st, 2021 in Philadelphia.
It was such a good time. Like you said, Tim, we were there with Maggie Freeling. Art Roderick popped out. He gave a special appearance and joined us on stage. The crowd went nuts. But we were also joined by over 1,000 loyal fans who laughed with us and were just on the ride of Jillian Pensavalle and Patrick Hines as they steered this bus through through the terrain of the documentary that we made with Oxygen and our documentary, Finding Maura Murray. It was sort of a roast, but I mean, my face still hurts from laughing. It was so good. And we haven't heard anybody come back to us saying that they didn't have an amazing time. And I think for a lot of people, it was the first time they went out to do something and be amongst people. And the energy in that room was explosive.
Absolutely right. It felt like 15 minutes up there on stage. It just flew by. It was an incredible night. Definitely be there in Philadelphia if you're around the city. It's going to be great. Underground Arts in Philadelphia on October 1st, 2021. And Lance, just to follow up on a recent episode of ours about Michael Packard, who was trapped in a whale's mouth in Provincetown, Massachusetts, or I should say off the coast of Provincetown, Massachusetts. Lance, Art Roderick, who was on the show with us in Boston this weekend, he lives in that area, and he is friendly with some of the people who know Michael Packard, and he swore to us that this really happened.
Yeah, we pretty much got the confirmation that this story is legit. Michael Packard did, in fact, enter into the mouth of a whale and was spat out after a few, 30 seconds or so. And yeah. And this was a confirmation that came from a very credible source who spoke to Art about it.
Yeah, and this is a former U.S. Marshal telling us he believes that it really happened, as incredible as it is. So I take his word for it. He also said that Michael Packard sustained a knee dislocation that was not reported, or at least not by us in our recent episode. I hadn't seen that anywhere. So that is an exclusive. We do send our best wishes to Michael and hope he's making a recovery with that injury. All right, Lance, and on to this episode with Maggie Freeling. In this episode, we speak about the podcast Murder in Alliance that Maggie Freeling does with the Obsessed Network, and it is sort of a spinoff of her other show, Unjust and Unsolved, and it is really great.
It's a phenomenal show. Maggie does such a great job with this. It's centered around the 1999, April Fool's Day of 1999, the murder of Yvonne Lane and her ex-boyfriend, David Thorne, who was the instant primary suspect, even though he had a solid alibi, and the fact that he is now in prison and Maggie is working on his case and his freedom. And Murder in the Alliance, I believe, is up to 14 episodes. Every one of them is absolutely riveting. Go check it out. And also check out their website, murderinalliance.com.
All right, everybody, I hope you enjoy this conversation that was recorded live a few weeks ago on Get Vocal on Thursday nights. We try to do them every Thursday night at 9 p.m. Eastern, so check it out if you can, and check out our website, crawlspace-media.com.
So my good friend Lisa Spees, who everybody knows, she came to New York, stayed with me for a few days, and we went and visited Ralph Stokes on Philadelphia death row on Tuesday, which was really intense. Ralph has done 40 years in prison for a crime he did not commit. He's been there since 1982. So that was horrible. And then today we went up to Sing Sing and saw J.J. Velasquez, who is in New York and is a good friend. And both of these cases were on Unjust, if anybody listened. So, you should listen, because they're both cases that are totally crazy, especially Ralph. JJ has a lot of potential to get out in the next year with the new DA we just elected in Manhattan, but Ralph is very stuck on death row for who knows how long.
Yeah, I want to know more about Ralph, and I think a lot of people do as well, but I just, real quick, do you have a stat of how many incarcerated are actually not guilty of the crime? Is there any statistic, or is it just sort of like, you know, they're not guilty, but you can't really put a number to it?
The Innocence Project definitely has stats. Let me look. I know that at the beginning of the podcast, I say 20,000 people is like the conservative estimate that they believe are currently incarcerated. And then there's also, you know, the ones who have been freed. It's really egregious. And then there's also like, there's like actual innocence. And then there's like, shouldn't be in prison because of, you know, whatever misconduct happened at trial. And then there's also egregious over-sentencing. So, you know, there's a whole bunch of issues that I would certainly umbrella under that, issues in prison and our system.
And tell us about Ralph Stokes.
So Ralph, he was 19 at the time, I believe, in Philadelphia, and he was charged, convicted of a triple homicide at a really famous restaurant called Smokin' Joe's, and it was owned by the boxer Smokin' Joe Frazier. And so it was just this like kind of crazy thing. The fact that there was really no media coverage on it was crazy. And so Ralph was convicted by prosecutor Roger King, who was, back then, he was a notorious prosecutor for securing the most death penalty convictions. You know, he was known as the guy that would sentence you to death. But now, fast forward, he is now known as a disgraced prosecutor because most of his convictions were based on lies, falsified evidence. Suave was convicted by Roger King. You know, as soon as I saw that in Suave's case, you know, that's a name that if you're familiar with wrongful convictions, if you're familiar with Philadelphia, if you see somebody was sentenced by Roger King, there is something bad there. So Ralph was sentenced by Roger King, coerced confessions, and sentenced to death as a child at 19 years old. So he's been there since 1982, and seeing a 60-year-old man who grew up in prison, death row, is really difficult and really devastating. And, you know, right now, there's no movement in his case. Luckily, Larry Krasner is still in office, and he has the conviction review unit run by Patricia Cummings, but at the moment, his attorneys, who are not great, is the nicest words I can say, refused to bring his case to the CIU to review. And they're prioritizing King cases. He would be fast-tracked, because not only is he King, he's a death row and done 40 years. So Lisa and I are really, really getting on that this month.
It's pretty remarkable. I mean, what's his attitude during all of this at this point?
Sweetest man ever. Like, he's just like my he's a grand, like, he doesn't have kids. I mean, he went to prison at 19, he didn't have kids, but he's like a grandpa. Like, I was just sitting there, and like, you know, he's got diabetes and arthritis, and like, he went to prison, he was this scrawny little thing, and now he's a you know, a big 5'11" 200-pound old man sitting across from me. You know, and I took his hands, I was like trying to massage his hand. I mean, when was the last time he even felt somebody touch him? And, you know, like, the guys in there don't really touch each other. He's on death row. He doesn't really have much contact with anybody, you know. So it was, that one was hard. That one was really hard. I've kind of been processing that all week. Like, this man has just grown up in prison, in some of the worst prisons.
And are you still covering his case on Unjust and Unsolved?
Well, I covered it on Unjust, but not because I'm doing Murder and Alliance. So no, but, you bet I'm on phones all day about his case. I'm sending FOIAs. I'm, you know, bothering politicians. I'm doing what I can to get his name out there. You know, Lisa and I are taking meetings all the time, just getting anybody who will pay attention to him to pay attention to him, because that's how these things make movement. We know Krasner knows his name. We know Patricia Cummings, who runs the CIU, knows his name. But they're also their hands are bound until his lawyers bring his case to them. They even came to his attorneys and said, hey, do you want to see the files from back in the day? It took him 15 months to even go and see these files to see if there was anything in there. I mean, they are dragging their feet. He's had a habeas in front of the court since 2013. Why has his petition been in front of the court for 8 years?
So you were seeing him in prison. That wasn't for season two or anything else. It was just for...
Just a visit. I never met him in person because of COVID. I started on just before COVID. And then right as we were getting ready to, you know, start visiting people, JJ, who I saw today, was the only person I got to visit. And right before that, COVID hit. So I never got to meet anybody in person. So, you know, I've been talking with Ralph for over a year. So it was really surreal. And of course, while I'm there, I bump into another person from Unjust, if anyone listened. John Brookins, he's another case. He's in the same prison. So I'm literally sitting in the waiting room or sitting in the visiting room with Ralph, and I see this guy walking back and forth, and you can't really mistake John Brookins. He's got like piercing blue eyes and, you know, really fit kind of short guy. And I'm like, that's gotta be John. There's no way that's not John. That's gotta be John. And sure enough, I hear the guard scream Brookins, and I was like, holy crap. So I got to actually meet John too. I got to meet two people that I hadn't met in one prison.
How did that happen? So you were waiting and you saw him walk by?
I was just with Ralph in the visiting room, and John had a visit with somebody else and he just walked by.
Then they allowed you to connect with him right there?
Yeah, I gave him a super quick hug and then they like separated us because we were just hugging and they were like, that's enough, Brookins. And they were like, get out of here. Your time's over. So... I don't know. I got lucky. We got lucky that we got to at least embrace.
Wow. What did he say to you?
He was just like, wow. And then I felt bad because I was like, oh, I'm here visiting another guy and not visiting you. But I mean, it was fine. He sent me a message after. He was like, wow, I can't believe I got to meet you.
That's awesome.
He just had a really devastating commutation hearing. He was denied his commutation. And he's got the Lieutenant Governor Fetterman on his side. I mean, these things are impossible. Even when you have lieutenant governors pushing for your freedom.
You have Larry Krasner, you have John Fetterman. I mean, these are like presidential candidates, by the way. Like Larry Krasner is probably going to run for president at some point. It just goes to show you how thick that wall is. That, you know, when they say, oh, he hit the brick wall, like that thing is like impossible to penetrate.
Yes, it is impossible because they don't want lawsuits. Exactly. I mean, that's what's happening in the West Memphis 3 case right now, if anyone's paying attention. When they took the Alford plea, part of that plea was they will not sue once they get out. And that was agreed upon, but their lawyers, when they made that agreement, said, okay, but we do want to exonerate our guys. So any evidence we want to be allowed to test. And so the agreement was they will not sue, but the state will give them the evidence. Well, guess what? The fucking evidence is gone. The state is not giving it up. They're saying the evidence is gone. So that's a breach of contract. And now the lawyers are thinking, okay, I think they can sue. If the evidence is gone, the contract is broken. So if anyone's keeping up on West Memphis 3, check that out. There's a lot going on there. They might actually... I mean, it's shitty. They won't be exonerated because if the evidence really is gone, there's nothing to test. And we'll never know who did it. But... you know, maybe they will finally get some relief. Finally.
Well, incredible work that you're doing with all of that. And it just goes to show how it doesn't end at your season finale, or it doesn't end at a certain episode. You carry it over into the other aspect of your life. Like, it is your life. The shows are just sort of the vehicle for the information.
But no, I just think it's really shitty when people, and I get that a lot of journalists are busy, like, you know, they're busy and they don't have time to stay on these things, but I just don't feel comfortable covering somebody's story and then being like, see you later, enjoy death row, goodbye. And that's why I've really kind of found this middle ground of activist and journalist. But yeah, I don't know how people do that. I don't know how. You know, it's talking to these people and how long they've been in prison and how many people have come in and left and come in and left. They get so nervous that, you know, they're just going to get lost. Someone's just going to leave them. They just never answer the phone again. And it happens all the time. And I don't know how people do that and live with themselves.
We'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsor. Lance, I'm so excited about this summer. We're getting out there. We're doing live shows. It is so fun to be out there. And it turns out to be really refreshing. It's almost like what happens when you play Best Fiends. It just refreshes your brain.
Tim, I couldn't agree with you more. And there's nothing better than getting out there and being amongst friends and family and just sitting back and soaking up some of those sun rays, all while playing Best Fiends.
Once you start playing Best Fiends, you just won't stop. Lance, I'm on level 5,375. What level are you on?
Well, Tim, I've just cracked the 4,000 level, and I am just so jealous of you because you just steamroll through these levels. You collect your slugs, and you move on. It's not my slug, not my business.
Well, it's one of those games that makes 30 minutes feel like 30 seconds, and it's totally free to download.
And it's way more fun than any of those other matching puzzle games out there, mostly because you can collect these adorable characters. They just keep on coming, and Best Fiends releases new challenges, new adorable characters, and new great themes all the time, just to keep you on those toesies.
There's just so much to love about this game. Give it a try and let us know if you love it as much as we do. Download the 5-star rated puzzle game Best Fiends for free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play.
That's Friends without the R, Best Fiends.
Thanks to our sponsors, and now we're back to the program. Maggie Freeling, tell us about your new podcast, Murder in Alliance. Tell us about the podcast and investigation.
Yeah, so David was one of the people that I covered season one. You know, afterwards, it was just one of these cases I could not get out of my head, especially because there are some cases that I've covered, you know, where they do have attorneys, they do have PIs, so I don't feel as bad not being, like, their person, you know, like, they have people. I'm not going to not take their calls. I'm not going to be their friend. I'm not going to not support them, but I don't feel the dire need to be there for them in the sense that I'm there for Ralph and whoever. So David was one of those people. He hadn't had anything since, God, early 2000s. I don't think he'd been in court since 2013. I can't remember, but I think that's it. I might be missing up a million cases. But yeah, so it just stuck in my mind. I mean, besides how fucking bizarre it is, he didn't have anybody. He had Sue, his wife. And she had done so much work for 22 years. Like, literally, God bless that woman. Like, we would not be here. The reason Proclaim Justice was able to take it so quickly was because Sue already had the files. They didn't have to track down prosecutors, get files, you know, subpoena, like, whatever. Sue had done it. So, you know, now I decided, you know, David needs something. He needs somebody. He doesn't have the PI. He doesn't have the attorney. We got to do that. There's no other way to get back in court until you have new evidence, especially in his case. His habeas was denied. So that's why I decided to do the full podcast on him. We were just thinking, you know, season one was great, but it was exhausting to do a case every week. I was really burnt out. So Patrick was like, why don't we try to serialize it? I know that wasn't what you wanted to do, but, you know, let's try to keep your sanity for a minute. And I was like, all right.
And you get to dive deeper. So what you're saying happened is this was a case that you covered on your show Unjust and Unsolved, which is about wrongful convictions, a different one every episode. And this was a podcast that and a project that you started sort of as a side project to dive deeper into one specific case that you couldn't stop thinking about.
Yeah.
There's a wrongful conviction. So there's someone in prison now that should not be in prison for this crime.
I believe so. Two people.
Okay. And then what do you do with that?
What do you do?
Yeah. So there's so many elements there because you can focus on trying to get those people out of prison, or you can focus on finding out who really did it or you think really did it or all of the above.
At this point, when you're at that stage where you've used up all of your appeals, you need new evidence to get back in court. So the chances of finding new evidence are slim. We've had as many documents as they'll give us. I mean, Sue's been FOIAing for 22 years. I've been FOIAing for 2 years. I mean, if they have something that we have not gotten at this point, I don't know if we'll get it. You know, so finding new evidence is really tough. Of course, there's the DNA that's never been tested, which we want to do. We need to get court orders to do that. So there is that. Who knows if, you know, it's degraded or what. So working with Proclaim Justice, John Danny and Jason Baldwin, the goal really is to kind of figure out who did it. I mean, that's where what they keep saying. I mean, it's just so crazy at this point to get them out. And we do really have to kind of figure out who did it and then move in that direction to get evidence, get DNA, you know, what we can to get back in court. And that's really tough. Solving a 22-year-old murder is quite the feat.
And what's your experience been like working with Jason Baldwin and the whole Proclaim Justice crew?
They're absolute angels. And yeah, I mean, it's you know, it's weird being a journalist working with private investigators because our goals are the same, but the way we go about it is different. So what they're trying to preserve any kind of integrity. So when something goes to court, so if you've been listening, you guys know I'm not doing the interviews. I just have, you know, a wiretap on them. And that is because if I was in there doing the interviews, prosecutors could say, she's there, you know, it was tampered, or, you know, they felt nervous because a journalist was there. So of course they're going to say this. They felt nervous because there was recording. So it's very important to not have that happen. It's very important for me to not reach out to anybody that could be perceived as tampering, like Joe Wilkes. Like, I'm dying to talk to him, but I'm not going to reach out to him. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to ask him questions where, you know, assuming maybe he did do this, then he has an idea in his head of how to answer them with John and Danny. So we really want to do everything like so by the book that the DA and the prosecutors cannot punch any holes in it. So as a journalist, this is very difficult not doing interviews, and they'll get back in the car and I'm like ripping my hair out like, why didn't you ask this question? We needed to know this question. And they're like, you know, and I'm like, no, I needed to know that for like my storyline. and then I don't want to step on their toes because of course they're professionals, but you know, so it's been hard for me at least in that aspect. Because it's a big waiting game. You know, I could reach out to all these people on my own and get what I need to make an episode, but I can't. So it's tough.
When did the decision happen where you would be listening in on these, interviews? And how did you take that? Was that your idea or was that their idea?
Oh yeah. Cause I was their like, idea. Look, I gotta have audio for this. It's a one-party consent state. I mean, you know, we've experienced that in the Mora case. I mean, sometimes that's a real shit luck for you, but, you know, for making a podcast, for me, it's wonderful. There are interviews we've recorded that I have not put out because it's a source that we don't want to burn yet. We don't want them to know that I know what they've said. So there is a lot of that, and we've been really strategic. It's been hard because I'm like, look, guys, next week I want to do this episode about this person, but we haven't really talked to that person yet, and it's like you don't want to give them the heads up, and, you know, it's like it's really been tough to do an active investigation with real-life consequences, trying to figure out who murdered this woman and, like, not fuck it up. And make a podcast at the same time and be like contracted to have episodes come out every week and beholden to sponsor. It's really fucking hard.
Real talk.
That's why. Sorry, everybody. We're going on a season break for a month. Next week is the last episode until September 9th because I do need time to get back to Ohio and get some of these interviews that we really desperately need. So surprise, season break next week, but it's a really insane cliffhanger.
Good.
Yeah.
You need a break.
You need a break. Yeah. Yeah.
Do it.
That's tough.
Yeah.
Are you producing as you go, or did you put like 6 episodes in the can and then you did episodes after that, or is it like how far ahead are you?
Right now, no. I was really far ahead at the beginning because I think up until 7 or 8, Psychic was 7. 8 might have been when we got to Ohio. So I had up until 8 or 9 maybe before it started like real-time investigation. And then it was just like, I had to make them week by week because I didn't know what we were going to be getting in Ohio. Like, that's when it really became like, I don't know how this story is going to develop or how this is going to change. And it's hard because, you know, people at the beginning that we thought was maybe a person of interest and are not, for the storyline, I still need to wrap that up for listeners. I can't have listeners be like, oh, but you brought up this guy. It seems like what the fuck happened to him? Like Quentin Artis, for example, I need to talk to him. As a journalist, I've called this guy out. He seems suspicious. You know, everyone, he's a really good person of interest. There's no reason why we don't think he did it, other than there's better suspects. But like, at some point, I got to follow up on Quentin. And they're not particularly interested in him right now. They're like, we don't need him right now. We've got other people we're following up on. But I'm like, yeah, but storyline and journalistically, I got to talk to this guy.
Journalistically, when you're doing a podcast and you're dealing with, working with people who aren't journalists, you have a hard time. And I'm not saying specifically with the group you're working with in Murder and Alliance, but just in general, when you're working with people who aren't journalists, where do you draw the line of like frustration where you want to like shake people and say, that's not ethical journalistically?
You mean in this investigation or in life?
No, I guess it was more of a general question when you're working with people, most like if it is in association with a podcast, but if you have something specific for this investigation, yeah, I'd be curious about that. I think my actual question is, do you ever get irritated with Tim and I because we're not doing something ethical just out of sheer naivete?
No.
Good answer. Moving on.
I think if there was anything you guys have done or we're thinking about doing, I feel like we've talked about it. I've been like, maybe you shouldn't have done that. But I don't think you guys have done anything like unethical. I mean, you guys are very thoughtful, like good people. That's why we're friends. If you were not, we wouldn't be friends.
Well, thank you.
I'm not going to be associating myself with like unethical people, you know, like you guys have made mistakes. I can't remember particularly, but you guys know when you've made mistakes. Like mistakes have been made. Mm-hmm. But you own up to it. And you're not journalists. You're not trained. You didn't do... Fuck, how many years of school did I do? 8 years of school? Master's degrees? You know, like, you guys are doing the best you can with what you know.
Then where is the line about interviewing witnesses? Like you were talking about earlier, you won't interview people directly. Is there a possibility to jeopardize things, even with what we do? Jeopardize things?
Possibly. I mean, anytime something could go back to court and you're not relying on DNA evidence... could be jeopardized. Let's say somebody you spoke to suddenly has a confession and they look back and they're like, oh, well, Tim and Lance put that in their head. And I mean, you know, it's different because anything we'd be using, let's say I was sitting there, they could easily say, well, he only said that because Maggie was sitting there and he felt nervous. So, I mean, it's different. But they also, you know, specifically for them, they want to talk to them so they can see their body language, their reactions, everything's in person so they can do that. And it would just be different if I was there. As soon as you bring a journalist in the mix, as soon as you say like, oh, this is on record, it changes things.
This is an interesting conversation, an interesting path to go down. Did you see the documentary series, The Sons of Sam?
Of course.
What about leading a witness? Did you think that Maury Terry was leading Berkowitz in especially the second time?
I know. Everyone said that, and I didn't really pick up on it when I watched it.
You know, I didn't either. And then I kind of fell into the trap of, like, listening to people.
And I guess I'm curious, like, what did they think was leading? The fact that he was only asking yes or no questions?
What defines the leading question? Because I thought what he was asking wasn't so much leading as it was just kind of getting to a point.
But it wasn't the best. You always want to ask questions where the person cannot answer yes or no. And that's all he did. It was yes or no answers. So a better question would have been, who did you do this with? You know, like something they can't just say yes or no. That puts him in a spot to say, I'm not going to tell you that. It was just me. Those are better questions to get an answer. I didn't think he was leading him. I just thought he wasn't asking the best in the best way possible.
Now, is that something that you tell your Murder and Alliance team when they're going in to do an interview? Do you ask them, or do you try to instruct them, say, like, stay away from yes or no questions? Here's an example.
They're trained PIs, so they know that already. I actually am learning from them interrogation techniques almost, listening to the way they do things. And when they come back, I'll be like, why did you ask it that way? Or why did you? So a lot of times they pretend like they don't know the facts. And it's very frustrating to hear them because I'll be sitting there screaming like, why the fuck are you saying this? And they'll come back in the car and I'm like, sorry, you guys got everything wrong. And they're like, we actually like got a really drunk one night. And I was like, literally your whole interview was not factual. And they were like, okay, you're being crazy right now. But they just were like saying, they kind of try and play dumb. Like they don't want to come at them like, we know that this was this date at this time. So it's more like, yeah, we heard you said this. And I'm like, no, but they did say it. We have the audio of them saying this. We know that they said this, but they want to like, it's a tactic. It's a tactic to like kind of play dumb and come off as really non-threatening and unassuming. So I'm learning a lot from them. They learn less from me than I learn from them. Let's put it that way. And it's fascinating. It's really fascinating. And I love it, you know, as somebody who I would consider myself a seasoned journalist. I've done thousands and thousands and thousands of interviews. To be able to learn from people is really great. I'm loving it. Frustrating, but I love it.
Is that something that they apply to different situations? Like this situation just kind of happens to be a situation where they need to act like they don't have all of the details?
Because then they're waiting for the person to fill in the details. Like they want to see how much they know. Like they'll mess up dates on purpose and wait for the person to be like, no, actually, you know what? I think my cousin died around then. I think it was actually 99. Like, you know, like, and then they'll realize, okay, this person does know what they're talking about because they're remembering a specific incident and they're correcting me. And now I know that they know what they're, it's really fascinating.
There's a lot of talk going on in the message area about people who are interested in becoming a private investigator, maybe applying. Is that something that you're interested in as well at some point?
Yeah, you can't be a PI and a journalist at the same time.
What?
It's a conflict of interest. Yeah.
We are.
We're PIs. We are investigative journalists and we have
doctorates.
And the benefit of being a PI is your license, you get access to databases, certain states you can carry weapons. The databases are incredible. They're really unreal. There's nothing I could even imagine having right now. Like, and that's the thing too. Like, you have access to everything.
That really excited Ms. Gags in the message area. That's what I want. Yeah.
Well, and that's why you have to get licensed to have these databases, because it's the same database as law enforcement has. So you have access to Social Security, birth date. I mean, you can easily commit any kind of fraud you want with the information you have on people. The first house they bought, you know, whatever. Every license plate, you know, it's a great avenue for stalking. It's a great avenue for fraud. So that is really why they make sure people who have access to these things are professionals.
Do you think Art Roderick would be proud of you if you said, I'm now a licensed PI?
Art's always proud of me.
Of course he is.
I make him proud.
And us too, right? And we make him proud too, right?
Yeah,
all the time?
You guys do.
Every day.
Every day.
Talks about us all the time.
Right? Doesn't he?
Listen, I talk to Arthur once or twice a week. Like, really. This is a solid friendship we have formed since 2016. This is a solid 5-year friendship at this point.
Good. Maggie Freeling, tell us about, in Murder and Alliance, there's an episode called The Psychic. Tell us about this episode, because I know there's been a lot of talk about it.
Have you guys heard it?
I have not heard this one yet.
This is the truth, Lance.
I have not heard this one yet either.
Good job. It is probably, so this is, like, you cannot make this shit up. And if anyone in here knows of another case where this has happened, please let me know. So the cops were stuck and went to a psychic. As we know, that does happen occasionally. Arthur was not surprised about this when it happened in the Maura Murray case, you know, whatever. So they go to a psychic. It's 1999. It's about a month after the murder. And they tape record it, which is also incredible because the amount of interviews that they did not tape record that are actually like material interviews. So for whatever reason, they tape record this. and the psychic's, you know, doing her psychic-y thing. And so when she starts asking for, you know, I need a guy with gray temples and I need a guy like this and whatever, they start telling her about all these people that are sleeping with Yvonne. And a lot of them happen to be cops. And so the psychic then starts realizing, why is your whole department sleeping with this woman? And she calls her a nobody. I mean, she says, why are they sleeping with this nobody? Who is this woman that they're sleeping with? And so it really flips and becomes an interrogation by the psychic to these two detectives on what the fuck is happening in the Alliance Police Department. And they are just naming names. I mean, they are throwing the entire department under the bus. Well, she was sleeping with this guy and she was hanging out with this guy and this guy was connected with this guy and maybe that's the drug connection. I mean, the amount that they said, they never thought this tape would see the light of fucking day. And trust me, they tried to not let it see the light of day. It was hidden and they didn't get the tape. I got the tape. I'm the first person to get the audio. No one ever heard the audio. They got David's attorneys in 2008 during one of his appeals got the transcript. So I got the audio a couple months ago. And it is just bonkers. So I'm just reading the comments. So I got the audio just through a FOIA because I knew the transcript existed. So the audio had to exist. And it did. And it's an old ass fucking tape. But luckily we got it on digital before that thing was gone.
You see, I'm so happy to hear this, and people are saying that it was the best episode, and I think I just have such a bad taste in my mouth from past psychics. I think that's why it wasn't like on the top.
She's not saying any bullshit. She's literally looking at these cops, and she says, what is wrong with your department? Why are they, my word is corrupt, but she's basically asking, why are they so corrupt? Why do they have drug connections? Why are they sleeping with this woman? Is she a sex worker? What is going on with these people in your department? And they throw every name under the bus. It's truly bonkers.
Because they just didn't take it seriously?
They didn't think it would see the light of day.
Yeah.
I mean, they didn't know that 22 years later, the guy that they put in prison is going to have people looking at this case. They weren't thinking that.
Right. So what makes the interview, the recording, you know, super interesting is not the psychic's psychic ability.
It's everything the cops say to her. The entire 2 hours, maybe, is them telling her who they think this could be, and it's not David Thorne or Joe Wilkes.
That is pretty nuts.
Which is also, you know, why we were able to investigate so quickly, because we already had names from the cops on who it could be, and it's half of their department.